Lesson 12. The Joy That Was Set Before Him. Memory Verse. Let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. Hebrews 12:1-2. Please, Zara, I want some medicine, tearfully pleaded a little Indian woman in my dispensary one day. Some fever medicine? I asked helpfully. No, no, I want some strong medicine, she sobbed. Is it for sore eyes? I asked. No, no, it's not that kind of medicine. Is it for ringworm? Oh, no. And for a few moments she cried and couldn't speak. And then when the words came again, she said, It's for my husband, to sprinkle it on his food, so that when he eats it, he will love me again. Of course, I didn't have any of that kind of medicine. But I have often wished that we could buy medicines like that. Wouldn't it be grand just to take a dose of some magic medicine and then be temptation-proof and sin-proof? All I could do was to tell that little Indian woman some nice kind things that she could do and say. But do you know, they worked. In a few days, she and her husband both called in all smiles and sunshine with a little present, as they do in the Orient, for Thara. And I know some little things that we can do and say, whereby we may be assured that we shall never fall. Messages to Young People, page 116. And whereby we may know that Satan cannot overcome him whose heart is thus stayed upon God. Steps to Christ, page 103. They are all comprehended in that little chorus we often sing. Turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full in his wonderful face, and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. Paul speaks of the power there is in keeping our eyes on Jesus. We all, with open face, beholding as in a glass the glory of the Lord, are changed into the same image from glory to glory, even as by the Spirit of the Lord. 2 Corinthians 3:18. My dear young people, here is the power that will change one's life and keep him from falling. And it comes when we lift our eyes to Jesus and gaze into his wonderful face. It is by beholding him, by meditating upon his love, that the power changes our lives. Let me read a little paragraph to that same effect from Education, page 282. As the highest preparation for your work, I point you to the words, the life, the methods of the Prince of Teachers. I bid you consider him. There is your true ideal. Behold it, dwell upon it, until the Spirit of the Divine Teacher shall take possession of your heart and life. Reflecting as in a mirror the glory of the Lord, you will be transformed into the same image. The great object of walking the Christian's path is to be like Jesus, and at the end of the way to be with Jesus. And here we have the secret. We must lift our eyes to Jesus always. We must gaze upon him always. For it is only by beholding that we can reflect his glory and thus be transformed. I wish it were possible for me to tell you that just as soon as we accept Christ, we will immediately be like him. That just as soon as we accept him, there will be no more struggle, no more need to learn patience, faith, and trust in God. that once we are baptized and take the name of Christ, there will be no more struggling, trouble, or persecution. But I cannot tell anyone such things, for they are not true. I read the very words of Jesus himself, speaking in John 16:33. In the world ye shall have tribulation, but be of good cheer. I have overcome the world. In Ephesians 6, Paul, talking about Christian experience, draws an analogy to war. Finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Put on the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil. Verses 10 and 11. Jesus calls it tribulation. Paul calls it a war. Daniel calls it a time of trouble such as there never was upon the earth. Paul uses another analogy in Hebrews 12. He refers to the Christian experience as a race, so intense that every weight and even the little things that so easily beset us must be laid aside. Now, although I cannot tell you that the Christian life is an easy one, that the pathway is always a rosy one, and that trials and persecutions will never come your way, I can point you to a guaranteed formula, the secret of being able to endure the trials and the shame and of running the race with patience. I can point you to a prescription that will help you to rejoice in spite of your trials. Here it is. 'Tis Jesus. I know of a world that is sunk in shame, where hearts often faint and tire. But I know of a name, a precious name, that can set that world on fire. Its sound is sweet, its letters flame. I know of a name, a precious name, 'tis Jesus. I know of a book, a marvelous book, with a message for all who hear, and the same dear name, that wonderful name, illumines its pages clear. That book is his word, its message I've heard. I know of a name, a precious name, 'tis Jesus. I know of a home in Emmanuel's land, where hearts ne'er faint nor tire, and his marvelous name, his own dear name, inspires the heavenly choir. Hear the melody ringing, my own heart singing. I know of a name, a precious name, 'tis Jesus. J.W. Chapman. I am so glad that after calling the Christian life a race, Paul also gave the secret of running successfully that great race. Let us read it in Hebrews 12:1-2. Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who, for the joy that was set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. There is only the one secret for all of us. We must keep our eyes upon Jesus. Let me bring you a few little homely parables from the jungles of Burma, that we may understand better the mysterious power there is in keeping our eyes upon Jesus. In my dispensary many years ago, a little jungle mother came to me with a 2-year-old baby boy on her arm. He was very sick, and as I looked at him and questioned her about his health, I quickly came to the conclusion that this little boy, first of all, had to have a dose of castor oil. Now, I don't like giving castor oil to people. I don't like the look of it or the smell of it. And whenever possible, I try to get out of giving it. So on this occasion, I told the mother how busy I was and gave her a spoonful of castor oil to give to the baby. As soon as I went inside, I heard the baby yell. I knew it would. I could in imagination see the baby spitting it out and the mother catching it in the spoon again. Suddenly the crying stopped, and I went out to congratulate the mother on her success. But when I got out on the veranda, there was the oil still in the spoon. The baby had not tasted a drop. But from the pack on her back, that wise little jungle mother had taken out a lump of native sugar and was holding it just beyond the baby's reach. She was saying, "If you want this lump of sugar, you must take your oil without any fuss." And I saw how very much that baby wanted that sugar. Oh, how he wanted it. He swallowed down his tears and reached out his little hands. But his mother said, "Not until you have taken your oil." He looked at the oil, and then at the sugar, and then at the oil, and then at the sugar. And then that baby boy quit looking at the oil. With his eyes on the sugar, he opened his mouth and down went the horrible castor oil. Then his hands grasped the prize. That mother has long since forgotten that dose of castor oil, but I never will. I know better now what Paul meant when he told us to keep our eyes on Jesus. That lump of sugar was not mixed with the oil. It did not take away the nasty taste or feeling of the oil, but it helped the little fellow to endure the hardship that went with taking it. Here is another parable. One day one of my boys came from school to the dispensary. I could tell by the way he walked that his head and his back were aching. As he came to the window, he said, "Thara, please give me a dose of quinine mixture." I said, "Do you like bitter medicine?" He said, "No, of course I don't like bitter medicine, but please give me a dose." I said, "What a funny boy you are. You don't like bitter things, and yet you come and ask me to give you a dose of the bitterest medicine there is." Then he said, "Thara, I'm not thinking about the bitter medicine. I am thinking about tomorrow when my head won't ache anymore and my back won't ache anymore, and I will be able to go to school again and play with the other boys again." So I poured him out a dose of quinine mixture. I saw him shut his eyes, swallow the medicine, and shudder from head to toe. He said, "Thank you so much, Thara." I replied, "What a strange boy you are. You don't like anything that is bitter, but you come and ask me for it, and then when I give it to you, you say thank you." But of course I know why he said thank you. If we would only keep our eyes upon Jesus, we would long to be like him, and we would desire nothing more than to be rid of the miserable malaria of sin, which makes us come short of the glory of God. Even if it needed some bitter draught, we would dare to ask God for it, if thereby we could become Christ-like. Here is still another parable. I was on my way into the village of Nong Kering for my quarterly visit. I was carrying in supplies for Thara Peter. Ordinarily, it was only 3 miles from the river bank where we left the river boat, straight across the rice fields. But this was the monsoon season. It had been raining for a month, and the paddy fields were filled with water and mud. A number of them had already been planted, and I had to zigzag my way, walking on the narrow mud walls of the terraced rice fields that lay in the way. There was a hard 2-hour journey before me. I had an umbrella over my head. I had a big pack on my back and big gum boots on my feet, but frequently I slipped into the mud over my knees. And I want to assure you, it is no joke sitting down in a mud path to take off big boots and to pour the mud out and then put them on again. As I slipped and plodded along, I was saying to myself, "Oh, there'll be joy when the work is done." And if you can understand what I mean, I was feeling gloriously miserable. Just then I came to a little terraced rice field where there were about a dozen people planting rice. I could tell by the way they straightened their backs that their backs were aching terribly. Their lips were blue from exposure. Their clothes were sticking to their bodies, and their fingers were all wrinkled, as though they had been washing dishes all day long. I was genuinely sorry for them, and to an old man who was nearby, I said, "Uncle, I'm so sorry for you." He looked up at me, and not understanding what I was sorry about, he said, "Huh?" I said, "I'm sorry because you have to work so hard and that you have goose flesh all over your body from the cold." "Huh?" he said. And I said, "You are standing in soft, oozy mud up to your knees. I am so sorry you have to work under such unfavorable circumstances." And then a smile broke out over his face. Turning around to his companions and pointing to me with his thumb over his shoulder, he said, "Poor white man, he doesn't understand." Then with his face all aglow, he said to me, "Oh, Thara, don't you know? This is the best mud in all this river valley. Look how nice and soft it is. See how easy it is to poke the rice in. We have been planting rice ever since early morning, and we will plant until we cannot see another stalk of rice in our hands. This is good mud. Mud like this will grow 40 bushel of rice to the acre." If a sermon is judged by the amount of good it does, and by the length of time it is remembered, that was the best sermon I have ever heard in my life. I went on my way saying to myself over and over again, "Good mud, good mud. 40 bushels of rice to the acre in mud like this." You see the meaning of the parable, don't you? My dear young people, when we become truly hungry and thirsty after righteousness and determined to feed on the Word of God, we shall be so anxious to see the fruits of the Spirit come forth in our lives that when we pray for patience and God sends trials, we will be able to say, "Good mud. This is the kind of mud in which patience grows." In the little heartaches, we will be able to recognize the very things that produce the glorious harvest. 40 bushels of rice to the acre. In mud like this. Let me tell you yet one more little parable. One day I went to the village of Abawa to inspect the school at the regular half-year period. After school, the usual company of village patients flocked in for treatment. They had sore eyes and malaria, and there were teeth to be pulled. While I was at work, one poor man came up the ladder groaning pitifully with a huge abscess on his wrist. He said, "Quick, Thara, quick. Get your knife and cut it. Cut it deep and squeeze all the matter out." But I said, "My dear man, it will hurt if I cut that." He said, "Never mind if it does hurt. Come quick, get your knife and cut it. I said, you are the strangest man I have seen for a long time. Do you like people to hurt you? No, no, he said, of course I don't. But I have not been able to sleep or eat for 10 days, and I am thinking about being able to sleep again and eat again. Come on, take your knife and cut it. I said, you want me to cut you and deliberately hurt you? He said, please don't wait any more. If you think it is because I will make too much noise, call those 6 big men over there and make them sit all over me, and then take your knife and cut deep. And I did that very thing. I called 6 big men nearby to sit on him, and they sat on his stomach and on his legs and all over him, and held his hands tight. The poor man gritted his teeth and grunted and said, Doctor, I'm all ready. Now cut it. And I cut it, lancing the boil so deeply that he groaned with pain. When I whispered, shall I stop now? He cried, no, no, keep on. Don't stop till it is finished. I cut and I squeezed it. I poured in red-hot iodine. He cried and wept in agony. Shall I stop now? I asked him. No, no, keep on, he said. I kept on till the boil was lanced thoroughly and drained properly. And when at last it was all over, and there was a nice clean bandage all around his arm, he sat up, moved over beside me, took my hand in his, the hand that had cut him, and hurt him, and stroking it, he wept out his joy. Oh, thank you, doctor. Thank you so much. And now, my dear young people, can you understand the meaning of these simple parables? Do we really, truly long to be like Jesus? Do we long to speak like him, to act like him, to look like him so much that we would be willing to say, oh, Lord, if you see some terrible habit that is robbing me of my goal, cut it out, Lord. Cut deep. Hurt me, Lord. Do anything as long as I can be rid of that thing that is keeping me from being like thee. I believe that is what Paul meant when he said, run with patience the race that is set before you, looking unto Jesus. For in the 11th verse of that same chapter of Hebrews, Paul adds, now no chastening for the present seemeth to be joyous, but grievous. Nevertheless, afterward it yieldeth the peaceable fruit of righteousness to them that are exercised thereby. What could be more joyous than to have a life filled with the fruits of the Spirit, and thus to be like Jesus? This assurance is given in a paragraph from Education, page 192. As the student of the Bible beholds the Redeemer, there is awakened in the soul the mysterious power of faith, adoration, and love. Upon the vision of Christ the gaze is fixed, and the beholder grows into the likeness of that which he adores.